All right, here we are.
Here we are. Welcome back.
Welcome
Science
back.
In Between.
In Between.
I'm Ollie.
And I am Scott.
Yes. And yes. And what episode is it? I don't even know.
It is like 180 foot diggity diggity 185, I believe.
185.
It is an odd one. Yes, it is 185.
Yes.
185. Not a prime number.
No, it is not. No, no. It is not.
Sorry about that.
I a friend of mine just had a birthday recently, and he is back in his prime. My birthday's in actually it'll be right about when this episode drops, and I also will not be in my prime then. So just
continuing to not be in my prime.
Not in my prime.
Look at
it
me.
Just lowers expectations for myself and others, you know.
Sure. I think that's great. I mean, low expectations are the foundation of success, I think.
I can better meet lower expectations.
That's right. I clear that bar almost every time.
Yes. Yes. All right. So I'll set this up because I threw this out as a possible topic this week.
Yes, you did.
Earlier in 2024, the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, they have an Office of Educational Technology.
Mm-hmm.
And they published a report, and they've done this a handful of times over the last decade or so, where they have what's called the National Educational Technology Plan. And usually it's like a guiding policy kind of document that's just trying to, you know, really set the stage for what, you know, the Department of Education wants to see happen in schools. And this one I think is pretty novel, because outside of like, you know, previous versions really focused on like technology, you know, hey, here's how people should be teaching with technology. This I think took a little bit of a different perspective because it focused on the inequities in our school, in our school system. And and I thought that would be a good thing for us to talk about because, you know, we talk about lots of things, right? We talk about, you know, science and practice and, you know, ambitious science teaching and technology. And, you know, this whole podcast was built on, you know, how do we use technology to support science instruction during the pandemic? You know, that was like at least the seminal moments of the beginning of this podcast. It's evolved, but I think, you know, us going back a little bit and cycling back and talking about some inequalities and how they are presented within this document might be a good conversation to have. And it also might, you know, raise some awareness to this, because I don't know how much people are aware that, you know, there's even a Department of Educational Technology, right? Did you know there was one? I don't know. Maybe.
I did, but I think that's probably true that a lot of people don't know that it exists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a huge document, and it's like 130 pages long or something.
Yep.
It's not for the faint of heart, right?
Nope.
If you are having trouble sleeping, this might be a thing to read through.
Yep.
But I think that if you were in a school, if you're a teacher in a school, which is maybe under-resourced, this may be a conversation to have with some folks, at least, you know, to better have the vocabulary to describe the things that are going on. Because one of the things that it introduces is this concept of the digital divide. And this is something I think is, you know, most people are pretty familiar with the digital divide.
Yeah,
right?
I don't think they introduce that, do they?
No,
I mean, that's been a term that's been around for a long time.
It has been a term that's been around for a very long time. It's well researched. However, I think most people just see it as a single thing. And it's a much more complicated concept than that. I think they see it just as there are people that have technology and there are people that don't, right? And that it's mostly around socioeconomic status, which is, you know, fair. That's a fair way to conceptualize the digital divide. However, this broadens the scope pretty significantly. So it's not just about access. That's just one aspect of the digital divide.
Yeah. So they break it into three, one might call them buckets.
Oh, geez.
And then within each bucket, they make a list. Welcome to the show.
Oh, I even started the preview, the pre-show. It
You
was like,
start. You,
let's
it's your
not
fault.
talk about buckets and lists today. That
Okay,
was the, and
we
here we
won't talk
do it.
about
Like
buckets and lists.
we made it
Oh,
all of like 6 minutes.
yeah. Would you like where? Which bucket would you like to start with?
I think it's more of a typology. Is that a word? Typology? Yes.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so that's like a scientific set of buckets.
All right. Well, no, but I think they capture different parts of this, right? I mean,
Sure,
it's looking.
but that's the truth about those things. I mean, yeah, yeah, let's look at it. I'm not, I mean, yes, it is. Well, we're not going to go down the bucket and list
Sure.
rabbit hole. We're just going to talk about this document.
Yes. So that, like, let's start with the access one because I think that's the one that most people are familiar with.
Okay.
Only because the way they talk about it is that digital access divide stands between those students and educators who have equitable, sustainable access to connectivity devices and digital content, and those who do not. And I think that most perspectives is based on socioeconomic status, and that's it. And like I said, that's a fair way of looking at it. But I mean, it's incomplete in that there's also access based on a student's abilities or disabilities, right? And so there's a whole section of this that outlines all the different ways that technology can afford accessibility for individuals. And I think that's important. That's an important thing because it highlights that access itself is a pretty complicated thing.
Yeah, and I think certainly one of the areas where probably technology has been least effectively implemented in schools is the ways in which it could potentially support students who have, broadly speaking, disabilities of various kinds, right? But specifically, physical, vision, speech, hearing disabilities, like those kinds of things.
Sure.
It's an incredibly powerful tool for those students, and I think it has been used to some degree, but it's certainly not used as much as it could. And then that goes into, the universal design for learning principles
We've
that
talked
this
about.
document talks about and we've talked about, but that when you design for students who have particular needs, you often support many more learners in the classroom than just the ones you're designing for.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that for me, one of the things I think about this and it's a good educational document. Like, it's a really good primer and it gives lots of recommendations. Like, what's the purpose, do you think, of this document? Like, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be like, 10 years from now, we're going to look back and say, well, that National Educational Technology Plan from 2024, that really made a difference?
I do not think that we will say that.
It'd be great if it did, because I think there would be some real structural differences in our and systemic differences in our country if it did.
Yeah, I mean.
I mean, I think it's really good at highlighting the issue, right? It's really good at highlighting the complexity of the digital divide issue and what it does in our country in terms of, their technology is one of those things that there are people and districts that are in a privileged position, and educators are in a privileged position because they have tools. And I'm not just talking about things that plug into walls, right? I'm not just talking about, because the, you know, they this is a digital thing, right? But it's not just about like, laptops or iPads. It's about like having the technologies that individual students need to be able to better access things. So like if you have a student in your classroom who has some sort of visual impairment, are they getting the needs? I mean, are they getting the tools that they need or, whatever, right? I mean, that creates some real challenges,
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing I always struggle with is, and you and I have talked about this on this show and outside this show because we both have sort of an ed tech-ish background, right? Is there's always a tension with educational technology about, and this happens in many other areas of education, but in educational technology, it's often very pronounced, which is, do you extract educational technology and talk about it as if it is independent of the system in which it is a part, or do you talk about it as an embedded part of the system? And So, you know, the classic example is the ed tech class, which I taught when I was at University of Michigan,
which I teach now. I teach.
Right. But the version I'm going to talk about, the version sure. I taught, which I don't think is the version that you teach, which was like, okay, week one was, you know, let's talk about PowerPoint and how you use that in a classroom. And then the next week was, let's talk about, you know, whatever new technology, like, and not even necessarily new technology. So it was like a survey course of different technology tools and yeah. how you use them. And so it was completely extracted from any kind of real context. And you try to zhuzh it up with some context, but you know, usually you end up having sort of not very productive conversations about these tools. And people don't learn much about them because they're not really using them for an authentic yeah. task. They're just sort of doing something.
It's abstract. It's like the tool in the abstract. And usually I had that class did exist at Millersville, and we've changed that class a lot so that now it's taught with some sort of project based that's connected to a field experience.
Yeah.
And so whether that it has existed like that in previous versions, but we've worked to provide more context for the tool examination. But I think that a lot of times it's just about getting the tool, right? It's just about like, hey, here, you know what the tool does and you have it. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like mm-hmm. so much is about like, OK, hey, we have a one to one and let's just get all kinds of technology and drop it into schools. And the reality is that this document showcases that it's a little bit more than that. But,
yeah. Well, I think there's been some of that in the past, certainly. Right. Because there
sure.
were the ed tech community has always complained that like you buy a bunch of computers, you buy, you know, interactive whiteboards, you put them in every classroom,
oh my
but
gosh.
You don't give professional yeah. development for teachers to help them understand how they can best use those tools. You know, then you end up with a lot of expensive technology that's getting underutilized. But, you know, the reason I brought that up is this document in many respects does extract technology as an independent factor.
Sure.
And I think, it does itself and the people who are trying to think about technology and educational technology specifically, it does them a disservice because, you know, fundamentally what they're saying is there's this long history of technologists thinking that technology is going to transform schools, right? And we've talked about this multiple
yeah.
ways on the program, right? MOOCs being the most...
Well, that goes back a long
extreme
ways,
example.
Yeah.
I know, but I just remember... Like,
No.
When they talked about MOOCs were going to wipe out higher education, that they were going to be the new way that all, you know, education gets done. And that, you know, but that is an extreme example of something that's been happening since, you know, the chalkboard, which is like new technologies are introduced and everyone thinks this is going to change the way that we teach. And not to harp on a thing that we talk about on this program a lot, but here we go. You know, it's really about the practices. It's about what yeah. do you do in the classroom. And the technology can be useful, but it can also be unuseful in those practices. And so it's not just that folks don't have access or folks don't do the design or folks, you know, and some of the language in here I really struggled with these like profiles, like we're going to develop
right.
profiles
I struggle with that tag, right.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, so you are going into the other two digital divides, so we might as well go unpack those a little bit too.
Name them at least. Yeah.
Yeah, at least name them. So they talk about the digital design and the digital use divide. So the digital mm-hmm. design divide and also the digital use divide. And so, you know, you can follow along that, you know, I mean, they are what they're named. Like the digital design is that, you know, not only do teachers and principals and schools have access to this stuff, but they're actually designing and they have the professional development and all the knowledge needed to be able to integrate that into their classroom.
Yeah.
So there's that. And that from a use perspective, that's the third piece from my perspective is that not only do they have access and not only know how to, you know, they're planning for it, but they're putting the students in the position where they can do creative works with it. Not just like, hey, let's use this as a way to consume information. Like, let's sit on Study Island for the – yeah.
There's the practices bit.
Right. Absolutely. I'm going to sit on Study Island. I'll put my kids on Study Island or something for the next 7 hours. And then that's something that they see.
On Academy.
Yeah, or Khan Academy, is that what we see is that, you know, high SES schools are using technology for kids to be creative, and low SES schools typically don't. They put them in put students in a position where, you know, more passively using technology to acquire information, you know, and that is a real challenge, right? Yeah, I mean, the one there's some things in here that, like, the profile's definitely like, this is the profile of what a student should be, a profile of what a teacher should be, for the digital teacher, the digital student. That's one that I definitely I bristled at too, right? Those are things, because it's like, okay, what does that model individual look like? I have some trouble with that.
Well, and you know, again, it's built on the idea that it's the built on the idea of individual cognition, right? Here's the individual profile of the learner, and we want to try and improve that profile. And there's also stuff about then, okay, well, then what are they going to do? They're going to develop rubrics and assessments and different way. Like, the whole model is very traditional in its, you know, and this is the thing that I think is really interesting is, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Like, we've been talking, ed tech has been saying most of what is in this document for as long as I can remember, since I was a school teacher, which would have been in the early 90s, right? Which is, well, it can't just be the technology. We got to think about what the kids are doing with it, and we got to think about how the teachers are prepared to do it. And they start, you know, this whole report is built on the instructional core. They talk about students and teachers and the curriculum essentially as being the triangle that's the instructional core. And then they use that to break out these different divides. So I just, you know, again, for me, it's like they say in their pieces here that essentially, and you said a version of this, right? Which is, we don't want kids just doing using technology in old-fashioned ways, in unproductive and non-creative ways. And the places where it's not being used that way, where it is being used in creative and productive and designy ways, is in high SES schools. That statement, if you take technology out and put in any other thing, is always going to be true. Like, the
Right.
best educational contexts are the ones that are most highly resourced, have the parents who have access to being able to interface with the school on a regular basis, all these other
Right.
attributes,
They
all the
always
other
have they have
privilege.
more staff, you
Yeah.
know. So,
They have
you
everything.
know, so teachers aren't necessarily used for, you know, those sort of like managerial roles in the school, like, you know, hall duties or lunch duties, or, you know, high resource schools are the ones that, you know, give the teachers more time to be able to, you know, access professional development and experiment. And, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, it's like the whole way down, right? I mean, there's
Right.
inequities, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, and
There
that's
are,
definitely.
and that's why, you know, for me, this report is sort of like, well, what we need to do is what? Like, they're saying we need to improve and not have the low SES essentially, because that's the divide, right? We have the
Right.
high SES schools and low SES. We don't want the low SES schools to be doing what they're doing now. We want them doing what high SES schools are doing. And so they develop this regime of things that are going to make a change like that. And that was the argument for standards when standards came along, is like, oh, well, we want these low performing schools to perform at a higher level like high performing schools do. So what we're going to do is we're going to assess them, and we're going to use that as data to help those lower SES schools improve. Well, that's not what happened. What happened was that those assessments were used to punish low SES performing schools
Right.
and
Yeah.
take resources from them and close them and do all those things. So, you know, when I read this document, I'm just sort of like, well, okay, so I've heard a lot of this stuff before. How is this proposing any sort of, I mean, really, the solution is we should try and create equity in terms of SES
Yeah.
across schools. And
But
that would help tremendously with all the problems that they name.
the portraits of a graduate, a portrait of an administrator, and a portrait of an educator, those are pretty important things to engage with. I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah.
I could
Good.
tell that
Yeah.
it didn't land that way with you.
Not immediately.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
They have these supports and these scaffolds to help you with that, like to help you develop, or a reader to do that. I felt like the need to at least highlight this, because I wanted to unpack this. This is a quote that someone, you know, someone in this article, someone in this report says, when the principal sneezes, the whole school catches a cold. This is neither good nor bad. It's just the truth. Our impact is significant. Our focus becomes the school's focused.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So this is like empowering administrators. It's designed to like say, hey, you as a school principal have a lot of power.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. What? How's that land for the, with you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's both true and untrue, right? I mean, it's true in the sense that part of the reason that we saw this huge influx of technologies in these waves, right? And sometimes they're funded by, like in Pennsylvania, we had a funding initiative. When was that? It was 10 years ago where, I don't remember the name of it, but there was a funding initiative for the state where they basically passed out lots of money for people to buy technology, and lots of school districts bought interactive whiteboards or, you know, class sets of computers or whatever they did with that money. And then, as is so often the case, it turns out that that had very little instructional impact. It just went, it went into this black hole of technology. So, but administrators are the ones that make those kinds of decisions. They're the ones that say, yes, I am going to buy an interactive whiteboard for every person in my school or in my district, because I think that is an important, you know, emerging technology that that teachers need to be able to support good instruction. So I do think administrators have incredible power. They also have relatively weak power over the individual classroom practices of teachers. They have power, but it's not a, it's what do we call that, soft power? I don't know.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's the power versus influence.
Sure.
And I don't even know if that's a distinction. It's just what I'm thinking, because they have. Like, I just know in a lot of schools in our area, the typical principal usually is in a school for 3 to 5 years.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit longer, not much more, right? Like, I have a really good friend who just stepped down as the school principal and moved into a district office position. He was the longest tenured principal in the county, and I think he was there for 15 years, which is a real anomaly.
Yep.
Right. It's a real anomaly that somebody spends that long as a building principal.
Yep.
So that is influencing, that is both power and influence when you're there that long, right? Because you have the ability to, you know, implement change, implement new initiatives, and then see them through.
Yep.
Right. Because like, how long does it take something to really impact the culture of a school? I would argue it's not 3 to 5 years, right?
Yeah,
it,
or at least that's the low end of where
that's
you start
the
seeing
low
change.
End, right. Yeah. To really make substantive changes at a school, it takes a lot longer than that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just look at, you know, I know, I mean, you know, a collegiate environment, but we have a provost who's been here for 3.5 years and still approaches things like she's a novice. Like, I'm still new at this.
Yeah.
Right? And she's been there for like 3.5 years, and she's like the number, she's like the, you know, top academic,
academic officer.
Yes.
Yep.
Exactly. And so like, talk about power. She's got a lot of power, and it's just a, you know, still approaching things like, oh, I'm still figuring things out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the case with a lot of schools, because there are, you know, really complex things to understand.
Yeah.
And so while they have, you know, they have the power of the purse string, right? The school, mm-hmm. you know, to whatever extent that a district allows that to happen, because, you know, the funding structures are different in different districts. But a building principal has a lot of, you know, power over the purse string. So can, you know, really use that to say, okay, here are the initiatives that I am passionate about, or the ones I think are important, or whatever. But when it gets down to the actual culture within a classroom or the practices within a classroom, yeah, that's a hard sell, you know?
Yeah. It's a long game, right? I mean,
it
if
is.
You want to change the culture of any large group of people, whether that's a company or a school or a whatever, like a football team, like whatever group of people you're trying to change the culture of, that is a thing that takes time. And you can do it in different ways, but either way, it takes time. And in some places, it takes more time than others. I mean, obviously, football teams, it's easier to change the culture because for lots of reasons, though I imagine there are some that don't change very well. But schools, whether they're higher ed or K-12 schools, are very slow moving creatures and take a lot of time and energy to change things. So yeah, I think leaders have the ability to impact that, but they are somewhat constrained by how difficult it is to change the culture. But I do want to comment on your thing about the financial, and I think that is important. And I guess for me, what I look at this document, I would say I would much rather have us spending a tremendous amount of the technology budget. And what I mean, I don't want this to be technology, but I think we need what we need if we want to change the things that they want to see changed, which is essentially the practices of what's happening in schools. That needs to be a professional development effort, not a technology effort. Technology has proven since the beginning of its, you know, its introduction to schools that it is not an agent of change. It can contribute, but it's not all the glory that we anticipate from technology changing schools has not done it. And the reason is that those tools have to be used within a system of practice, and that system of practice hasn't changed that much. And it certainly hasn't changed that much as a result of technology. I mean, technology has pushed it here and there a little bit, and standards have had an impact, but really it's the fundamental underlying model that we have of how schooling works that's the main problem.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing, and it does attend to that a little bit. Just that before I jump off this, it does say that historically investments in building professional capacity around the use and design of lessons with ed tech have paled compared to the billions of dollars invested annually on the technology itself. So it attends to that.
Yeah,
but I think what it does is it really focuses on capacity, and it doesn't talk about practice, right?
Right. Well, even in the quote you just read, the thing that it focuses on is designing lessons that include or use technology. It doesn't say like designing good lessons.
Right.
Now, technology may or may not be a part of that good lesson, but the assumption is if they know how to use these technologies, whatever these technologies are, from the chalkboard to, you know, to what's that, Class Dojo. I got beef with Class Dojo, but anyway, that, you know, whatever the technology is, that it's that they, the reason that these practices haven't changed in classrooms is because teachers don't understand how the technology works. And I genuinely don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is that it's difficult to change the practice of teachers and schools, not that the reason that they're not changing is because they don't understand the technology.
Or that, well, I mean, I was going to say, or they don't have the money, but it's like, they can't. I mean, money is absolutely. I mean, that's the
money's
the
always
heart of all,
I mean,
of, at the heart of all
to capitalism,
of right?
Yeah, I mean,
it's at
yeah,
the heart of all of this.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. But I think I'm having my students read this in class, mm-hmm. in my doctoral class, only because, you know, digital divide is one of the things that is a focus of our program. It's not really research based. I mean, there's some research based aspects in it that it cites a lot of stuff, but it's all like policy documents and things like that, you know, more so than, hey, here's this, you know, study of practices in, you know, in a classroom setting, and these are the ways that students, you know, use technology. It's nothing like that. It's all, you know, large and, you know, quasi experimental stuff, you know, that.
Yeah. Well, they did have one of our hated words in here, research-based, comes up a few times about like, oh, research-based practice. But I guess, well, one of the questions I have for you as, because you're definitely more in the technology space than I am. So,
sure.
I mean, my sense is that one of the critiques of this term digital divide is that it's a deficit perspective, in the same way that lots of things that are like that are. So, I mean, what's your feeling about, is this taking a deficit perspective when you call this a digital divide, or is it just sort of stating a condition, or like, how do you think about that?
Yeah. So I mean, it's definitely a deficit perspective. And I guess, are there times when it's okay to use a deficit perspective when we're talking about things systemically versus talking about people?
Hmm.
Like,
Interesting.
it, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. No, I mean, I'm not defending it.
I didn't think you were. But it is
the language that people use within this field, right? And digital divide is one of those terms. If you go to Eric or you go to EBSCOhost or something, you can do digital divide and you'll get like thousands of hits.
Sure.
So it is the term. And I guess until someone comes up with a better term, but I mean it really focuses on the systems and the resources within those systems. You saying that now is the first time I've actually thought about it from that perspective, that it is a deficit. But I think that I have to think about that a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of that deficit thinking comes from the same perspective, right? When there's differences between the performance of one group versus another, there is built into that a sense of like, oh, these people are lesser than, right? In some measure. And that's what we mean by a deficit perspective. We're saying these people have a deficit, right? So the people who are whatever, don't have access to technology, don't perform well on state exams, don't have, well-resourced schools with a good gymnasium and an arts program, like those people have a deficit, however those people are characterized socioeconomically, racially, demographically, urban right. versus rural, whatever it is. There's always lots of factors you can use to layer on to why these deficits exist. But I guess it is for me problematic or challenging or something to do that in that way, right? I mean, it goes back to, we've talked about this before, sort of asset ways of thinking about it. Like what are the strengths of the school or the group of people or whatever, as opposed to what are they missing? Because I think one of the challenges, and this is why I struggle with rubrics and assessments, is if what we're doing is setting standards and then using rubrics and assessments, well, the standards are usually based on the high SES schools, right? So they say this is the standard. And so anything by comparison then is less than. So it's a tricky business to have the people that are in the position of privilege set the standard and then evaluate everyone else in a deficit perspective from that point of view. So that's the way deficit perspectives work, is you've got people right. with privilege who set up an assessment and say, this is what intelligence is. We're going to measure it this way. And anybody who's got a low score has a low intelligence. It's like, well, you sort of set the test up so that you were the one that got the good score on the test.
Right.
So it gets a little awkward to say that everybody else is low when you're the one that set the terms of the exam. So.
Yeah, I don't know what would I'm like in my head thinking what would be a better term, and I mean that's above my pay grade.
Yeah, for sure.
It's way above my pay grade.
But I think the thing that that I think I would love to see in these documents when these folks get together is a sense of there. Again, it ends up being, we're focusing on too small a grain size thing. Like technology is not a large enough part of the system to have massive impact on the way that schools operate. So we can think about like, oh, well, what we really want to make sure is that kids in low underfunded urban schools have access, and it's probably in this case underfunded rural schools, have yep. access to the internet, have access to computers in their homes and Wi-Fi in their homes, and I'm not saying those aren't good things. I think those are good things, but focusing on that then makes us think that if we solve that problem, we're going to solve the larger systemic problem. And the pattern, at least over the last couple hundred years, is that's not the case.
That's not how it works.
Right. Getting Wi-Fi for those kids in rural communities may help them, but the kids in the privileged communities are still going to be ahead of them in lots of ways. And so how do we think about those right. differences?
Yeah, because it's not just about technology. It's also about food insecurity. It's also exactly. about access to healthcare. It's about, all of the things, right?
Employment,
right.
Access to good employment, access to, I mean, it all comes down to, in the end, privilege, right? Like the more privilege you have, the more likely you are to be successful. It turns out like it's not that complicated a system. And privilege in this country is very strongly linked to SES. It's linked to other things too, but certainly if you're rich, you can get a lot more done, and your kids are going to be much more likely to be successful than if you're poor. And by successful, again, we're still talking about like making lots of money.
Yes. Woo! That's it. That's your definition of success over there, Scott.
Yeah, that's right. I clearly I chose based entirely on income.
Yes.
Yeah. As did you.
Yeah. All right. So digital divide or some other term.
Some other term.
Some other term.
Yeah. To be invented by Ollie and I in the future and coined so that we will make a bajillion dollars. And
right.
We
we'll write
finally,
all the books.
We will have the privilege we deserve. Thank goodness.
No, I'll pass on that.
No, thank you.
All right. Hey, you have any joys?
Yes, I have joys.
I have a pretty good idea where you're going to go with this, but you go ahead.
Well, I could. Yeah. I mean, well, I have, I guess I could. No, I'm gonna.
Oh, no,
I'm,
I don't mean a side rail you or anything like derail you, I guess.
I'm gonna. I mean, I was this. We are recording this. If we're allowed, are we allowed to talk about the time?
Sure,
or is it evergreen?
You clearly talk about whatever you want to talk about.
That's true. That is a good point. Thank you. I'm just gonna talk about my joy. Let's start there.
Sure.
So I am reading a book, and I'm almost done with it, but I'm really enjoying it. So I'm gonna name it as my joy. And it is called Martyr with an exclamation point. And I've got to find the author. I didn't look this up in advance, which I should have done, but it's a 2023. It's a new novel. And it's just really exceptional. It's about a Persian Iranian kid who's born in Iran and comes to the US when he's very young and grows up in the United States. And he's a poet. But he's got lots of other stuff going on. He and his dad come to Indiana, to live. And because his dad gets a job at a poultry processing farm, essentially. And his father was, I'm trying to remember. I think he was a doctor, but he was prestigious and had a good job in Iran. And he comes to America for lots of complicated reasons, but one of them being to provide opportunities for his son. And it's just a really well done book, and it's interestingly structured, but it's written by a guy who is Iranian and is a poet in his other life. So he has books of poetry that preceded this novel. So it's, as is so true of so many things, it's got to be somewhat autobiographical. But yeah, I've been really enjoying it. It's really well written. It's very poetic, not surprisingly. Like, a lot of the language is beautiful, but the story is just really compelling. And I don't have the quote. I was going to pull the quote because we were talking about this. But one of the things he has this quote about, essentially about buckets, right, which I liked, which was, you know, his struggle about, like, is he Iranian or is he American? Is he, I mean, there are multiple, he basically names multiple attributes of his identity and saying he doesn't feel comfortable in, Muslim or non-Muslim, you know, in being in any of those things. He feels like he doesn't want to put himself into any of those categories because he doesn't feel like any of them really represent who he is. So I just, you know, it's just a really thoughtful and nuanced portrayal of a person who's struggling to figure out what to do with their lives. So it's really, it's a great book.
Sounds it. Yeah. I'll have to check it out.
And all while right, so you're talking, I'll quickly find the name of the author.
All right. So I have a joy that's kind of hard to describe as a joy. I'll say that, what brings me joy is learning about things and learning about, especially about things that I didn't know about and about things that, make me feel. And so I just finished a podcast series called The Kids of Rutherford County. And this was off my radar. And I guess it came out in fall 2023. But I was listening to another podcast, and this was advertised. And usually that just drives me bananas when it's like I'm commercials, right? but it said, oh, this award-winning podcast. And I'm like, how is it award-winning when I haven't heard, like, I'm like, both of us are pretty on top of the podcast world, right?
Yeah.
And here's this, and it's what, like, in that, like, Serial, you know, productions, NPR productions. So it's like,
so right, it's like a high production value podcast.
Right. And it's in our wheelhouse, right? These are things that should be. So I listened to the first episode and then I was hooked. And it's about Rutherford County, Tennessee, and how over the last 20 years, since like 2020, like since 2000, year 2000, they created a juvenile justice system in the county in which kids, and I say kids, like as young as like 7 and 8 years old, if they got in trouble, they would be charged and detained.
Like as adults, basically.
They would be put into a juvenile facility.
Wow.
So they would be arrested and detained for a period of time. And in some cases, put in solitary confinement.
Oh. Wow. Okay. Okay.
And these practices were still going on up until like a year or two ago. So this is not like, and it was absolutely inconsistent with state law.
Right.
And you know, the public defenders were like, this is against the law. And one judge was like, this is my courtroom.
Yeah,
this is my courtroom. This is Rutherford County. And she's like the mother of Rutherford County. That's how she described herself. And it's four episodes. It is, as a parent, I am just absolutely, I mean, I was moved. Yeah. I was moved because, you know, I've seen like 7 and 8 year olds and then, you know, the dumb things they do. And
sure.
Like to think that like, you know, some of these things, and they like were coming to elementary schools and arresting kids
like
from the school
class
and taking kids off of school buses and things. And so it's kind of hard to call it a joy in that that I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I absolutely felt anger and, you know, so much emotions over this I have to recommend it. It's a hard listen. It's a hard listen. But it is something that I think deserves more attention because this is the county in which it was exposed. Right. This is a county in which it was exposed. But what other practices like that? What are the counties and is stuff like that happening? I don't know.
Yeah.
But whenever something can shed the light in darkness, I feel that needs to be celebrated and shared.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to listen to that. Yeah. There's speaking of Serial, they had a series where they went to the Cleveland, justice system and studied it, you know, did a whole series on it that was fascinating as well. So that one, but wow, this sounds intense.
Yeah, it is intense.
And
so there you go.
There
hard
you
to
go.
Call it a joy.
Yeah. And I'm going to just say Martyrs author is Kaveh. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Kaveh Akbar. So Kaveh Akbar. But yeah, it's, two joys. Both of which are complicated. One clearly a lot more complicated than the other. But yeah. All right.
Well, that's kind of like a damper. What a fun episode this was.
It was a fun, yeah. Woo. Usually,
yeah.
Usually the joys after like a rocky episode like bring us back up. This one just went right off the cliff into the bottom.
Yeah, it just was more of the same.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
All right.
Hey, we'll catch you next time.
In between.
See you then.
Bye. Now.